Charles Williams also does, and something again we will look at later, is he produces an extraordinary vision of the Arthurian myth, which again is based upon the sense of the coherence of everything being connected. And he bases it on the image, the ancient image of the united Roman Empire, or in particular of Byzantium, of the sense of a world where everything is connected at different levels. And he calls it the organic body of life. I'll just read you a little bit of a poem called The Vision of Empire, which is his sense of the universe. The universe is this deeply interconnected place. The organic bodies sang together. Dialects of the world sprang in Byzantium. Back they rang to sing in Byzantium. The streets repeat the sound of the throne. The acts issue from the throne. Under it, translating the Greek Meninskeli to the minds of the tribes, the identities of creation, phenomenally abating to kinds and kindreds. The household inscribes the acts of the emperor. The logothetes, these are the messengers, the angels. The logothetes run down the porphyry stair, bearing the missives through the area of empire. Taliesin, so he's a, Taliesin for him is the figure, is this Welsh, great Welsh poet, who is the witness of the whole Arthurian epoch and who writes it all down. Taliesin walked through the hither angels, from the exposition of grace, this would be the art, to the place of images, which would be Yesod. The morn brightened on the golden horn. He heard behind him the chariot's clatter that bore a new matter to all the dialects. He saw the nuncii, these are the papal nuncii, the messengers of the Pope, loosened on the currents over the seas in the mechanism of motion. Rowers' arms jointed to the imperial oars. Chariots and galleys sprang from the shores. The messengers were borne over sea and land. The king's poet gazed in the mirror of the horn. The morn rose on the golden horn. I saw the identities imaged in a sapphire sea. Beyond Sinai, Ararat, beyond Ararat, Elburz. Elburz is a mountain in Caucasia. Light sprinkling, flaked snow sparkling, chastities of ranged peaks of Caucasus. Snows glow on the world's brow, charged with deep veils of green. The missives of identity came from the scribes where the tribes gather and keep holiday on the name day and birthday of their father, the emperor. The empire's sun shone on each round mound, defending dales of fertility. The bright blades shone in the craft of the dancing war. The stripped maids laughed for the joy of the province, bearing in themselves the shape of the province in the rounded bottom of the emperor's glory. Spines were strengthened, love settled, tossed to aerial gulfs of empire. The lost name, the fool shame, fame and frame of lovers in the lowlands of Caucasia rang round snowy Elburz. The organic bodies sang together. So this image really of a completely interconnected world where there is constant conversation from the place of the tribes, which are the places of the, if you like, of the separated and tribal places, to the sense of the place where everything comes together and the single point that generates the wholeness of things. So there is a whole, so the image really that he is producing, if you like, from in all his works, right, is this sense of profound interconnectedness and the centrality of each human being as part of that. So each of us sits at the center and the circumference. Each of us is part of the great conversation. So in the meditation, when we were going across the sea, looking at the book of tales and seeing the great tales of the world, and then within that, seeing our own tale, wrapped into that. In a sense, this is the territory that we're looking into together in this course. We're looking at how do these great myths interact with the story that is our story. And in the knowledge that it is crucial for us to do this. If we look at what C.S. Lewis did, C.S. Lewis did a really different thing from either of the other two. Because C.S. Lewis is an interesting figure, because unlike when Tolkien was a Christian always, C.S. Lewis was a full-on atheist and completely cynical about Christianity, and becomes converted to Christianity. And then in his Narnia stories and in his space trilogy, brings out a profoundly imaginal form of Christianity. And as well as actually becomes a Christian apologist, in his lifetime the best known of all the Inklings. Tolkien is now better known than him, but C.S. Lewis was the great figure, great speaker, great teacher. Tolkien was not a very good teacher, really, much better writer than a teacher. But if you think what C.S. Lewis gives us with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, is this sense where he regenerates children's imagination, that sense of going into the wardrobe, finding the door at the back of the wardrobe, finding the lamppost where you encounter Mr. Tumulus, and are then taken off into the dangerous and powerful land of Narnia. And produces an image, interestingly, renewed image of Christianity, the image of Aslan as Christ, the Christ lion, is very appealing, very beautiful. Because what he does is to take away the hackneyed images, the desacralized images of Christianity, and finds a way to reinterpret them in a much deeper, much more kind of connected way. Well, that's his books for children, but his space trilogy, which is Out of the Silent Planet, Voyage to Perelandra, and That Hideous Strength, is his books for adults. And here he really looks at the nature of what has been lost and what it needs to be found, and the nature of evil. We'll look at this again at some other points, but what they're all doing, in a sense, you get this nexus point, if you like, where Western Europe and Britain in particular has become thoroughly desacralized, and no one, they had no knowledge, these men, that their books were going to do anything at all. They used to sit in the Bird and Baby, the pub in Eagle and Child, the pub in Oxford, and they were a little group telling each other stories. And yet those stories, they never, they wouldn't have known it. Tolkien wouldn't even have known it, really. These stories would continue to be retold in different ways. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis are the most famous, but even C.S. Lewis within certain sections, even Charles Williams, books get reprinted, poems get reprinted. Now the question is, what do we do with this, right? What is the point of studying this? What's the point? It's like saying, what's the point of poetry as well, I suppose. But the whole point about these stories is they wake us up. When I read that little bit of The War in Heaven, that very powerful, extraordinary bit of that story is because the spiritual being, this being of the priest king, who represents magic and holiness and faith in life and connection, and you can hear the character, you hear the characters touching into that in their own way. They can't quite remember because they've this idea that we have all found that. So Barbara had it just before she gets married, in her vision of what marriage might be like, perhaps. And Kenneth has seen it in a priest somewhere, touched that sense of holiness, or in other places, in places I can't remember. That's the other theme of that. We've touched it. I can't remember where, but I know I've touched that. So one of the points he's making there is that we've all touched into that sense of magic and holiness. We all have a direct relationship to that, but we have forgotten where. And in a certain sense, the much of the point of that book is the recovery of that. It brings us, the book does hold this sense of the Grail, because it has this sense, because all the different characters, the very first character, Lionel, who's, you know, this extraordinarily incurious bloke, who has this profoundly pessimistic nature. There's a wonderful bit in the War in Heaven where they say to the Gregory Persimmons, I won't tell you because you read the book, but Gregory Persimmons is one of the characters, a Satanist, and he is trying to intimidate Lionel because he's threatening to have to kill his son, and he's threatening that he's trying to coerce Lionel into becoming a Satanist. And so pessimistic and cynical is Lionel that he regards Satanists as total lightweights. Because they're just hopeless goths, really. Because Lionel really understands how malign the universe really is, and so it's ridiculous to expect him to become a Satanist and sort of, because actually that's just nonsense. He's at a, you know, and actually what you see happening to Lionel is that turns around. He turns around to say, it's not like he becomes a biblical Christian believer, but he becomes available to through his wife and son to the possibility of growth and love and kindness. So his deep, bleak pessimism is interrupted.
So what book is that from?
It's called The War in Heaven.
And this is Charles
Williams.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
How significant do you think this is that these particular stories and things were coming from a time of a profound emotional disattachment that was part of the English character and was something that was actually celebrated, if you like, to be emotionless? And I mean, you know, I know, remembering Lord Peter Wimsey, in the courtship scenes, they have to speak in French to each other because they're too embarrassed to say anything loving in the English language, you know. And I just think, here they are, this all-male society, teaching all these boarding school boys as part of as their profession, and not desperately, but deeply understanding that actually love and connection are the building blocks of the universe. And it just seems such a strange... It just occurred to me, it was interesting.
Well, it's a curious... Yes, it's a curious thing, isn't it, Ben? Because it's... Because if we think of exactly that, they're teaching in Oxford, the C.S. Lewis and Tolkien are. I mean, Charles Williams is a different case entirely, really, because Charles Williams is much more working, you know, is working class. The others are not, really. And it's sort of interesting in a certain sense. I mean, the C.S. Lewis in particular, because he really didn't understand intimacy at all until much later on in his life when he has. But of course, he has quite a brief marriage with. But he writes incredibly beautifully, really, about his grief. Tolkien was very happily married all his life, and kind of had a real in fact, his wife comes into his mythology. Really, there's a figure in his mythology called Luthien, and a famous love between Beren and Luthien, and on their grave, underneath their actual names, are the names of Beren and Luthien, because for her, she was his Luthien. She was his figure of beauty and muse in lots of ways, and so in some ways, curiously,
yes, in Shadowlands, we watched that recently.
Yeah,
it famously shows C.S. Lewis's kind of detachment from his own emotions, and so it's, yeah, beautiful.
No, it is. It's kind of curious, and actually, one of the difficulties between Tolkien and C.S. Lewis is C.S. Lewis could not understand why he was attached to his wife. And found it irritating that he wanted to spend time with her and not time with him, you know. So it is really kind of interesting, really, what's happening among these men.
I wondered if the World War One, first one, had served them up like Robert Graves. I don't think he ever really came back to be normal because he was so shocked out by PTSD or whatever. I wondered if these writers have also had that experience where
a
whole world turned upside down.
Well, certainly, that is true of both of Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, not so much Charles Williams, because I don't think he fought in the war. He was a little younger. But I think certainly for Tolkien, you know, both of them, they lost many, and certainly the experience of the war was very pivotal, really, for both of them. And it's not an accident, in a way, that Lord of the Rings is about a great war. You know, that eventually they triumph over darkness. So that, you know, so certainly you just see that was kind of, although in fact, you know, the thing about Tolkien that's interesting, in his personal life, he's actually a very available man, loved his sons, loved his wife. So in his personal life, he doesn't seem to be as damaged as some others might have been. But it's almost certainly true that his writing of the legends, because part of that he was writing while he was literally in the trenches with bombs going off all around him. So certainly his legends were a refuge for him, really, a way of kind of not being in this brutal sort of world.
And there's the film about A.A. Milne as well, coming out with the Winnie the Pooh stories, and in a way talking about his breakdown as well because of the war and finding refuge. But I read some of the A.A. Milne stories, and they're again so beautiful about love and helping each other and community building. And then he had all those personal relationships with his son and everything.
Very complicated, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I think that's it, in the sense that the First World War runs like a fissure through the collective consciousness, having all kinds of effects. You know, and of course, what we also know about it is the precursor to the Second World War. It sets up that war and the way in which Germany is treated at the end of that war sets up the conditions for the next war, because of the brutal way the Allies treated Germany at the Treaty of Versailles. So we created the conditions for the rise of Nazi Germany. So in a certain sense, the two wars run into each other, almost certainly.
The interesting thing, you know, I'm very, very taken with this idea of the English character and all the things we associated with it, because, you know, those men came back from the First World War and they did not breathe a word about it.
Yeah.
Maybe they did in the British Legion, but they certainly didn't in their own homes, because, hey, they went to war to protect their families. And, I mean, I only know about my own family and, you know, that sort of thing, but You know, there's never, men never spoke about it, their experiences, and they certainly wasn't counselling, you know.
Oh, no.
They were just, my old teacher had, what's it called when they get terrified in the trenches? The war, you know, the war shakes. What do you call it?
Shell shock.
You mean shell shock, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, he got a job as a head marshal and just carried on, but, you know, there were times when no one could see him, sort of thing. But no one ever spoke about it or anything. It's weird, it's like looking back into history now. And yet, it's interesting that the animal kingdom and the occult world allows these people to express things that actually have to come out, you know, of vital parts of their creative process and character, even though so much it has to be repressed in the everyday world. Just a thought.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think, you know, it's not even necessarily just for the English character. I think one of the things you find that when people have been through enormous difficult traumas, then they bury it, and they don't want to remember it, and don't want, you know, it's certainly true about survivors of the Holocaust, that they will not speak about it, not even think about it unless they have to. But in a way, you know, the problem is if we do not interrupt these things, if we do not work, because the whole point about working, you know, looking at these myths, working with them, understanding them, is that that gives us the capacity and the tools to interrupt the automatic behaviors that happen if we don't do that. So let's break for a cup of tea, and then we'll come back to this issue after tea. So come back at 4 o'clock, and have a nice cup of tea.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ali.
Yes, Ali.